Secretary General, thank you for your time, and we all think you have got to be the busiest man at NATO headquarters this morning, so we're going to move very briskly because we know you're busy. Let me start. We want to move the discussion on defense spending ahead just a bit. This audience is one that knows all the parameters of defense spending and 2% and all of that. But aside from the accounting and the bookkeeping and the defense budgets, this has now become a raging political issue on the world stage, and in no small part because of President Trump. So, you had breakfast with the president this morning, as if anybody saw that. How did it go? What did you have?
Oh, we had excellent orange juice and some toast and some fruit salad and a good breakfast.
Good, oh, good.
Paid by the United States.
What? Okay. Everybody said you had a sense of humor. What can you tell all of us about your meeting with the president? And specifically, what did you hear from him about the United States' commitment to stay in NATO, to be committed to Article 5, to completely contribute to NATO? He says a lot of things. What did you learn about how committed he is to NATO, and is he?
So President Trump has stated many times his commitment to NATO and also to our collective defense clause. This was also an issue we addressed today, but for instance, when we met in the White House in May, he restated that to me, but also at the press conference in connection with the meeting, he was very clear on his commitment to Article 5, collective defense clause. For me, that is important, but it is also important that the U.S. commitment to Article 5, to European security, to NATO, is something which is demonstrated not only in words, but also in deeds, and actions speak louder than words. Because since Trump became president, U.S. funding for military presence in Europe, the European Deterrence Initiative, has been increased by 40%. So there are more U.S. troops, more exercises, more investment in infrastructure now than before.
But he comes out repeatedly in public in the United States and says he is not, you know, NATO is not worth it. He thinks there's very unfair, that NATO is unfair to the United States. He had recently, I'm sure you're aware, one of his rallies in the United States and used very unpleasant language that we won't repeat here to describe NATO. This has to be very difficult. Is this all just for political show? And does he really understand NATO? He says people aren't paying their fair share. Well, nobody pays to NATO, of course. Help us understand once and for all, is this political theater in your view? Does he really understand NATO? Because you're getting a lot of different messages from him.
You know, my main task is to keep 29 allies together. Therefore, perhaps it's not so useful if I start to reflect and comment on, all different hypotheses and ideas about what different political leaders think and believe. My main task is to keep us together. And I do that by trying to find common ground. So yes, I agree that President Trump has a direct language, plain speaking, sometimes very direct, pointing at specific allies. But when it comes to the core message, we actually all agree that NATO doesn't share the burden in a fair way. As we have to share the burden in NATO fairer than we do today. So we don't have a fair way of paying for the cost today. When it comes to the funding for the NATO budgets, the U.S. pays 22%. It's a cap. So actually, U.S. pay less compared to GDP than some other allies. because there's a cap on for 22% US funding for the NATO budget. But we don't speak about the NATO budget. We speak about total defense spending, which is something completely different. And then, of course, the US defense budget is by far the biggest. The figures we published yesterday shows that the US pays about spends about 3.5% of GDP on defense. Which is, of course, more than all of their allies. And that's the reason why we need to do something with that.
Does the debate now pose a political... We have the financial challenge, the budget challenge. Does it pose a political challenge for NATO, do you believe?
Of course, it is a political challenge that we have disagreements, part on issues which are not directly related to NATO, but of course disagreement on trade is serious, and my task is to try to minimize the negative impact on NATO from those disagreements. But we also have different views. We have an open discussion about, for instance, defense spending. And then I think that my message and my task is that, yes, I hear you loud and clear that some allies, especially United States, wants European allies to and Canada to spend much more quickly. But then I say that, well, let's recognize the progress. Let's appreciate that after the US has been pushing for more spending for many, many years, now actually something has started to happen. So this is something that the US can take credit for. Of course, European allies are investing, and Canada are investing in defense, not primarily to please the United States. They do so because it is in their security interests, but in addition to providing necessary capabilities, it also helps to create a more balanced or fair burden sharing alliance, and that's a good thing.
You mentioned trade, and I was very struck by your speech this summer at Lancaster House in London. You said that it was not written in stone that NATO would survive forever. You hope it does, but there's no guarantees. And you talked about the differences that are driving wedges in certain places. You mentioned trade, climate change, and the Iran nuclear deal. And you just mentioned trade again. And, of course, German trade with Russia came up this morning. So how much is the issue of trade and the U.S. push on trade reform now impacting a security alliance?
So far, it hasn't impacted NATO that much. I cannot guarantee that that will not be the case in the future, but despite these disagreements we have seen on trade, we do more together in NATO. So I think we understand that the transatlantic bond is not one bond. There are many ties. Some of them have been weakened, trade, political cooperation on environment. But when it comes to defense, we actually strengthen the transatlantic bond. We do more together now than just a couple of years ago. So this is a kind of mixed picture when it comes to how the transatlantic bond is now developing. Defense security has been strengthened. Trade, of course, has been weakened.
Going back to your Lancaster House speech, I mean, do you really worry, tell us, that NATO, there is no guarantee, NATO might not survive?
I said that because I think it is important to convey the message that the transatlantic bond, the NATO as a cornerstone of transatlantic security, it's not written in stone that we will be there forever. It's not a law in nature that we will have NATO forever. I believe it's possible, and we believe we both can and must preserve NATO, but then we need political commitment, we need decisions, and we need that we continue every day to adapt and modernize the alliance. The good thing is that that's exactly what we have been able to do over the last years. We have really implemented the biggest modernization, the biggest reinforcement of collective defense since the end of the Cold War. I'm actually quite impressed what we have achieved over a very short period of time. Second, we have had disagreements before, dating back to the Suez Crisis or when France left the NATO command structure in the 60s. You know, NATO used to have its headquarters in Paris. And then in 1967, we moved to Brussels because France left the military cooperation. I was not participating in NATO ministerial meetings in the 60s, but I guess that the atmosphere was not the best when we had to move. And then we had the Iraq War. So the thing is that we have been able to overcome serious differences before, and then unite around our core task. And I believe we both can and must do that again, because it is in our interest. And that's my main message, is that it is in the interest of Europe and in the interest of the United States and Canada to stay together.
Let me move very quickly, before we get to audience questions, to the subject of Russia. You, as I understand, as Prime Minister, did meet with Vladimir Putin. You Norway had engaged in, I believe, some fishing negotiations with him. So tell us about Putin. What's he like? Not that you're going to make recommendations, but we have a very important summit coming up in a few days between the President of the United States and Mr. Putin. What are you looking for? What should people be looking for? Is Russia, what challenge is it posing to NATO specifically here in Europe? What are your concerns about a Russian threat? Is there really a Russian threat, whether it be military, political, or economic?
So we don't see any imminent threat against any NATO ally, but we see a much more assertive Russia, which has used force against neighbors, Ukraine, but also Georgia, and they have forces in Moldova against the will of the government. And we have seen cyber, we have seen many other also activities of Russia which are malign. My approach to Russia is very much based on what I learned as a Norwegian politician. I actually started to work with the Russians in the 1990s, or actually 1990, when I became a deputy minister for environment. And since then, as minister of finance, industry, energy, and prime minister, I have worked with Russia in many different ways. Because Russia is a neighbor, and what we saw in Norway was that even during the coldest period of the Cold War, we were able to have a working relationship with Russia on border issues, on military. The Norwegian army have regular contacts with the Russian army in the high north. We work together with animal rescue, on fishery, on environment, and many other issues.
But now, today, do you have any cautions about the Putin government, their influence here in Europe?
Absolutely, but my approach to Russia is that we need to combine two things. We need to be strong. We need to be firm, and as long as NATO is united and as long as we invest in our defenses, we are firm and we are strong and we are united. As long as we are that, we can engage in political dialogue with Russia. Because Russia is our neighbor, Russia is not going to go away, and we need to talk to Russia. Partly to strive for a better relationship, which I think is possible. When that can happen, I cannot tell you, but I actually think it's possible to get a better relationship with Russia.
What should people be cautious, though, about right now, about Vladimir Putin? Should they just accept everything he says?
No, not at all. I mean, we don't accept his illegal annexation of Crimea. We don't accept cyber propaganda, interference in domestic political processes. We have seen it or Salisbury. We have seen a failed coup attempt in Montenegro. We have seen many examples. We don't accept that. But for me, that's not an argument in favor of isolating Russia or stop talking to Russia. Actually, I think the opposite. I think when tensions run high, it's even more important to talk to Russia, to try to reduce tensions. So even if we don't believe in a better relationship with Russia in the foreseeable future, we have to talk to Russia to manage a difficult relationship. Because we have more military presence, more exercises, more tensions. So we have to avoid miscalculations, incidents and accidents. And at least if they happen, prevent them from spiraling out of control and creating really dangerous situations.
Okay.
So therefore, we need military lines of communications. We need dialogue just to manage a difficult relationship.
And now we'll go to 3 hours of questions from the audience.
Yeah, that's good.
Somebody, I want to see some. Oh, there's got to be some hands here. Let me go back to this gentleman here behind you, sir. And I think we have microphones coming very quickly. And we'll have you introduce yourself and state a quick question so we can get to people.
Thank you very much. I am Federico Yaniz, a former retired general of the Spanish Air Force. And I have a question. We know all that yesterday was signed a new joint declaration of friendship between NATO and the European Union. There are 74 items that have been pushed forward for collaboration, for cooperation. But I think there is a big issue. The issue of coordinating NATO defense planning with the combined annual review of defense of the European Union, because you have mentioned many often that we don't have two sets of forces, we do have only one. Are you working on that way of coordinating those two systems on planning? Thank you.
Well, the short answer is yes. We need to have coherence between NATO defense planning and the efforts of EU to develop new military capabilities, because we cannot end up with EU asking for one list of capabilities and NATO for another list of capabilities from the same nations. In that joint declaration, we actually refer to that we need coherence when it comes to capability development. Let me add that I welcome stronger EU efforts on defense, because I believe it can strengthen the European pillar in NATO. But the EU cannot replace or be an alternative to NATO, and this is also very much underlined by EU leaders themselves. Especially after Brexit, we have to remember that 80% of NATO's defense expenditure will come from non-EU allies. So there is no way that EU can replace NATO, but EU efforts on defense can help to strengthen NATO.
As the clock is ticking down, we'll stick on this side of the room. There's a lady way in the back there, please. Over to this way, sir.
Dear Secretary General, Mr. Stoltenberg, my name is Hanna Hopko. I represent Ukraine. I have a very simple question. Ukraine spends more than 5% of GDP on security and defense. Also, Ukraine is contributing to almost each NATO missions. And also recently, Ukrainian parliament adopted one of the strong national security law. Ukrainian army ranks 8th position in Europe. And would you agree that Ukraine deserves an enhanced opportunity partners program, which we expected to receive this summit, on this summit, but unfortunately, due to the blocking by Hungarians, we are far from this. Thank you.
I don't expect NATO leaders to make any decisions on the enhanced opportunity program at this summit, but I know that we will reiterate our strong support for Ukraine. And we have many tools to develop our partnership with Ukraine. We have the NATO-Ukraine Commission, we have the annual national plans, we have a substantial package of support, we have the trust funds, so we have many different ways to work together with Ukraine. So I think we should focus on that, deliver as much content as possible in the existing frameworks, and help Ukraine focus on reform and modernizing their security and defense institutions.
We're going to try and get to three more questions, but let me start with two, sir. I'll impose on you to be as quick as you can be.
Yes. Hello. My name is Iskander Akhlbaev, and I come from Kazakhstan. There is a growing assumption that where Russia is portrayed as a medium-term threat, while China is portrayed as a long-term threat. Do you agree with this assumption, and how does NATO view Chinese policies in the Asia-Pacific or in the Eurasian continent?
So NATO is a transatlantic alliance. Of course, our main responsibility is in the transatlantic area, but we also, of course, have a global perspective of what we do. And we are, of course, aware of that China is growing. We have some military lines of... We have some contacts with China. I would like it to improve and to have more political dialogue with China. But, of course, we are strengthening NATO to be prepared for any potential challenges and threats, but at the same time, we try to reduce tensions, not increase tensions.
I'm going to call on the gentleman back there in the blue shirt in the interest of full disclosure, Phil Stewart from Reuters, another member of the Pentagon Press Corps.
Thank you. Do you think that President Trump's insistence on NATO defense spending is still helpful? Or do you think at this point it's becoming counterproductive and destructive to the political cohesion of the alliance?
He has a clear message. I think that has increased the understanding of the importance of defense spending. And what we see is that defense spending has started to increase. So I think that's what I have to say about that. The fact is that the defense spending is increasing.
You know, this is where the press corps says, but sir, I have a follow-up question.
Yes, I know.
We don't want to make you too unhappy, but I do want to give you, in the last 52 seconds on the clock, the real opportunity to articulate NATO and your views right now. You have talked about differences very openly. How serious is it? Is the U.S. government's position right now harming NATO cohesion? How convinced are you that it's not harming NATO cohesion?
I'm not a professor. I'm not a pundit. I'm not sitting here and just.
But you're the Secretary General.
Yeah, meaning that my task is to make sure that we stay together.
But if I
started to freely reflect on all possibilities, then I would undermine the unity of this alliance. So I have one responsibility, and that is to make sure that despite the obvious differences, which you can read about in newspapers every day, we have to keep this family together, 29 members, different from both sides of the Atlantic, different history, different geography, different political leaders. But as long as we unite around our core task, protect and defend each other, then we are safe and secure.
Are you willing to say what difference it is to wrap this up? What difference it is at the moment, your differences concern you the most as Secretary General?
No, as Secretary General, I'm of course most concerned about the differences on defense spending, but that's very much about messaging and language, because when it comes to the substance, we all agree that we have to do more. And therefore, I try to distinguish between what is different language, different messaging, and what is disagreement on the core task. And when it comes to the core issue, all allies and Canada agree that we have to invest more.
And on the messaging?
Then you, of course, see that there are big differences. I mean, some allies are very focused on the progress we have made. Some allies are, especially United States, are want to see much faster progress.
Okay. Well, now that you've had breakfast, maybe we'll let you get on to lunch. And then you can come back and tell us how that went.
Yeah, yes.
We want to say thank you. If everyone could... If we could have everyone stay seated so the Secretary General can get on with his day. And thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.